Do you think Democrats make a mistake? And I think basically the way they all look at a second Trump administration is, if not, you know, sort of the Weimar Republic 1933, you know, fascism will immediately be established. They just think it'll, you know, be total chaos. Nothing good will happen. Let's see, I want to welcome you to the second edition of the Liberal Patriot podcast. Last time we had Dave and Leonhard. I'm your host, Rui Teixeira, and I'm coming at you every couple of weeks or so with the very finest in a heterodox analysis and conversation with the most interesting and stimulating guests. And today we've got a corker, I like to say, because we've got Orrin Kass here. Orrin Kass is the founder and executive director of American Compass, which I describe as a small but mighty think tank, which punches like ridiculously far above its weight. He was Mitt Romney's domestic policy director in his campaign. After that, he joined the Manhattan Institute as a senior fellow, where he wrote a ton of interesting reports. In fact, probably the first time I encountered Orrin was he wrote this long piece that was in National Affairs when he was at the Manhattan, How to Worry About Climate Change. Just a really good piece. It's still out there on the internet. You can read it. And I thought he was just very sensible and smart about what he had to say about this issue. I mean, it was calm, it was reasoned, it was empirical. And not to reveal too much about my checkered past, but at the time I was in the Center for American Progress, which of course is, you know, climate alarmism was all the rage. And I was sort of sometimes I describe myself as a closet Lomborgian. I actually like thought people like Jorn Lomborg had some interesting things to say. And I was skeptical of the way that sort of the mainstream of the Democrats was approaching the climate change issue. And I just thought Orrin did a great job of laying it out in a reasoned way, what some of the problems with it might be. He's also written lots of other stuff with Manhattan. And he did a book, I guess, while you were still at Manhattan, right? The Once and Future Worker?
Yes.
Which I do recommend to everybody. It's a very stimulating vision for the renewal of work in America. And he started American Compass, that small but mighty think tank, in 2020. Still going strong today. In fact, the most recent big thing that you guys did, I guess, was rebuilding American capitalism, which is this fascinating compendium, which I was honored to contribute a little memo to, about how conservatives might approach the issue of a common good capitalism in a different way than they had been. So that's Orrin. It's all great stuff. I always find Orrin unfailingly interesting. And so let's just get straight into it. One thing I'm curious about, Orrin, is, you know, in terms of your evolution, when did you have your sort of epistemological break with orthodox Republican economics? That's a phrase from Louis Althusser, the famous French philosophical Marxist, who talked about the epistemological break from bourgeois ideology. So where did you make your epistemological break with orthodox Republican economics? Was it before Trump, after Trump? Was it... you know, just when did it, was it gradual? Was it sudden? I'm just curious about how that evolution.
Well, it was definitely before Trump. I think, you know, one thing I should maybe say is I was never an especially orthodox Republican. There's obviously an extensive training ground or gauntlet, perhaps, that the conservative establishment tries to run everybody through the summer programs and fellowships and internships to make sure that you come out properly prepared to recite the liturgy of market fundamentalism. And I sort of skipped all of that. And so I found myself, particularly in 2012, when I was then Governor Romney's domestic policy director, having an opportunity to work on an enormous range of policy issues and speak with a lot of leading experts. And certainly there were plenty of places where I sort of nodded along and, you know, yes, this was exactly what I believed too. And then there were other areas where I was quite perplexed by what seemed to be the Republican line that did not align especially well, among other things, with either reality or what I took thoughtful conservatism to command. But, you know, one thing I've written about in particular that that was sort of a moment of epistemological break for me, perhaps, was working on trade policy. And I think a lot of folks forget this now in the Trump era, but, you know, Mitt Romney on China was basically the same as Trump on China. Maybe talk, you know, it chose different words at times, but in
said it a little bit differently. Yeah.
in his criticism of the trading relationship in many of the proposals he came forward with, you know, that was work that we did back in 2011 and 2012. And I remember bringing him the initial briefing on, you know, here's what Republicans say about free trade. And he said, this is fine, but what are we going to do about China? And and I was sort of sent off to figure out, okay, what do we do about China? What are the leading economists saying about it? And particularly on the right, the economists were simply saying nothing about it. The view was that free markets and therefore free trade is good. And if China wants to subsidize stuff and dump it into our market, that's just fine because that means more cheap stuff for us. And that's all you're supposed to say about it. And partly just on the merits, that was so wrong, it invited a lot more thinking. But as a procedural matter, to see that an entire political movement and party and way of thinking about economics had gone so far astray also underscored to me that, you know, maybe the thinking of 1978 shouldn't be dominating our policy as conservatives to the degree we'd clearly allowed it to.
Okay, so what should be dominating conservative thinking about economics? This is a softball. And, you know, how is that conservative, right? I mean, and I guess the related question is, you know, if your version of conservative economics is truly a conservative economics, how did it even happen that Republicans, the conservative movement, became so enthralled to basically soft and sometimes hard libertarianism on economics and the role of markets?
Well, to understand what happened in the Republican Party and on the American right, I think you have to sort of think about the nature of the so-called fusionist coalition that was brought together in the context of the Cold War. And you know, with the work of Buckley at National Review, in a sense, what became the Reagan coalition was this set of, on one hand, sort of economic libertarians deeply committed to free markets, sort of above all else, social conservatives, who I would say are sort of the traditional conservatives, and then Cold War hawks, who were sort of very aggressive on foreign policy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And, you know, these three groups made a lot of sense as a political coalition in the context of the Cold War. What they had in common was a deep hatred of communism and determination to win the Cold War at a time when the left was frankly not very strong on that issue. But as is the case with any coalition, everyone sort of made their compromises and were given their areas to set the policy or not. And what you ended up with was the very libertarian economists being given pretty much free rein over the economic policy. I mean, you know, someone like Friedrich Hayek is a figure who we associate with the American right. He has a very famous essay titled "Why I Am Not a Conservative." This was hiding in plain sight. But as a political coalition, it made sense. And we were also at a point in our history, you know, especially coming out of the 1960s, where market fundamentalism seemed to be just fine. I mean, what free markets were delivering seemed, in fact, highly consistent with the social priorities that conservatives would have. And so these things sort of went together naturally. I think with the end of the Cold War, the advent of globalization, not only is this coalition not a logical one, but you also find the priorities of the free market libertarians and the priorities of the conservatives deeply at odds over questions of nation, over questions of family, over questions of the role of government and whether the public and our politics should have anything at all to say about how our markets are organized or what we want them to deliver. And so that's I think the fight that was suppressed for a very long time, but certainly in the Trump era has been brought front and center and you see playing out today.
Yeah, so you're saying at root, market fundamentalism is not a conservative philosophy, though it can coincide with it at certain times and places, but it's not certainly the essence of a conservative approach to economics and to society. So what is a conservative approach then? What is the essence of that as far as you're concerned? And how does that inform what you're about there at Compass?
Well, I think you have to speak in terms of both means and ends. And, you know, in terms of ends, I think you see the, you know, you sort of maybe best start at the end, where the libertarian point of view has essentially been that the free market and liberty are the ends unto themselves. And whatever comes out of that is what it is. Mm-hmm. They've sort of backed themselves into a corner of also claiming that it is also the best possible outcome.
Right.
But that sort of is the end of the inquiry. Whereas I think conservatives have a much richer conception of the common good, of human flourishing, as a set of conditions that markets can certainly support and can enable, but that they don't guarantee, and that certainly aren't the ends unto themselves. That what we are looking for is strong families and communities, an environment in which the next generation can be raised to build successful lives themselves. Certainly, a much stronger commitment to the sense of the nation itself as an important entity, to solidarity within that nation and relationships and obligations that are tying people together within it. And so if you take all of those as important ends, then when you get to that discussion of means about how you want markets to work, what you want government to do, you end up with a very different set of answers. Because of course, if the liberty and the free market is the end unto itself, well, then it's very easy. The means is tell government to get out of the way and go home. If you actually have a substantive conception of the common good that you want markets to be advancing, then you very quickly recognize that markets can advance those things, and probably can do so better than just sort of top-down government programs can. But that markets are going to need constraints. They are going to need to be shaped. You're going to need strong institutions within them. You're going to need strong institutions around them. And you're going to have trade-offs between your preference and value of markets and other things that you care about too. And so it is certainly a less clear-cut position than what the libertarians tend to be comfortable with. But I think it's an incredibly important one and something that the country has really suffered from lacking in this sort of fight between a left that has just said we're going to have government do more of everything and a right that said, no, just we're going to get rid of government. The idea of that, the book you referenced, Rebuilding American Capitalism, is that there's actually a middle ground here, which is to say capitalism is in fact the right system, certainly the best system anyone's come up with. But capitalism doesn't just function of its own accord. We actually need to have a conception of what we want it to do, and the role government's going to have to play in making sure it does that.
Well, let me poke you a little bit on sort of your differences with the Democrats. I mean, a lot of what you're saying would in fact be congenial to, with some modifications, to what a lot of Democrats would say about their general economic philosophy. So, how are you different then from what we might think of as being the standard democratic approach at this point to political economy? What's your differences with them?
Well, I think one question is certainly what you mean by Democrat, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you're the difference with today's Democrats and the difference between a 1994 Bill Clinton Democrat are going to look themselves different. I think, you know, even going back to a 1994 Bill Clinton Democrat, what you would see from conservatism is probably a much greater commitment to traditional institutions. The idea that, in fact, that strong families are sort of an indispensable building block that you're going to have at the foundation of then strong communities that are going to have to support healthy markets. And the nation and so forth. Now, I don't know what Bill Clinton himself would have said he believed in terms of what the Democratic Party was allowed to talk about. Certainly, you weren't allowed to necessarily say those things in those terms. And I think likewise, then when you start to think about the role of government, I think you would always have seen Democrats having relatively more confidence that government is going to be able to sort of figure things out, deliver effective programs and services itself, make choices within markets, where I think conservatives are going to be a lot more likely to say, actually, just as a pragmatic matter, government's not going to be able to do that. Or even in principle, we prefer the private ordering and leaving it at least to the state and local level, and in a lot of cases to people themselves. So even with a sort of competent, moderate Democrat of Bill Clinton's variety, I think you'd see a lot of differences. When you talk about the Democratic Party today, then, of course, you have to realize that they've sort of gone crazy. And this is obviously something that...
Okay, well, talk about that. I mean, so when some people argue, hey, you're for industrial policy, they're doing the industrial policy thing. They're talking about, not worshiping at the altar of free trade. They're doing a lot of things different than people did in Clinton's times. And at least in a very surface way, might have some similarities to what you advocate. So why would you say they've gone crazy? Not that I think that's a crazy idea, but explain to me what you mean.
Well, right. So let's come back to industrial policy right at the end, because I think that's an especially interesting and complicated in a productive way issue. But if you think about a lot of the core things that I was describing with respect to conservatism commitments, what you have today from the Democratic Party is on a whole host of issues, essentially both a sort of refusal to impose any of the constraints that you need to have either in the market or in the society and the culture. Immigration is in many senses the quintessential example of this, whether you're thinking in cultural or economic terms, just an inability to take the issue seriously or provide the kinds of rules and enforcement that you need for a functioning market or nation. I think you see, it's been very interesting to see on China, where you have some people in the Biden administration who are actually quite tough on China, and others who tend to be running the most of the economic policy, who still sound like, Bill Clinton in 1999, talking about how we're, going to benefit most when we have the freest and openest trade and partnerships and so forth. And then I think, you certainly see the same thing in the kinds of issues the Democratic Party has chosen to emphasize, student debt forgiveness. You were mentioning kind of climate change and green policy. If you look at what labor unions today do, it is no longer actually advancing the interests of workers at all. It's advancing a mishmash of Democratic Party priorities. So, we could go on and on. I think the reality is that, part of the reason you see this realignment happening in American politics is that the actual very diverse working class base that used to identify with Democratic Party no longer does. And it's not exactly clear, other than a very kind of bubbled set of professionals, who the Democratic Party is even speaking to or for. The industrial policy question is an interesting one and speaks to both sides of this, because you definitely do see both in the Democratic Party and in the Republican Party a lot of interest in industrial policy, a recognition that, in fact, we are going to have a role of public policy in the economy if we're going to be getting the kinds of investments we need in the most valuable and productive sectors and so forth. And, semiconductors tends to be the kind of quintessential example right now. It's fascinating to see what has happened on that over the past year. You had the so-called CHIPS Act passed on a bipartisan basis. And what did the Biden administration do? It then went and immediately piled on this set of sort of socially progressive commitments around childcare and diverse hiring and environmental this and that, all of which that are in direct conflict with the actual goal of being a leader in semiconductors. And so on one hand, you could identify that as an area of potential agreement. On the other hand, I think you again see where what I would say conservatives certainly, and frankly, a lot of unfortunately quiet but sane liberals would say, you know, what you actually have to do to reclaim leadership in semiconductors is very different from what the Democratic Party is willing to do at this point.
Yeah, no, Ezra Klein, I think at one point described it as everything bagel liberalism. You know, there's nothing that we need to leave behind here in terms of, you know, piling stuff into a bill to do a good thing. And as you point out, it's both theoretically and practically, there's a contradiction between doing that and actually accomplishing the stuff you want to accomplish. So yeah, I'm not unsympathetic to a lot of what you're saying, Oren, at all. But you know, let's turn back to your, you know, the sort of your target of opportunity, or what you like to be a target of opportunity, the conservatives and the Republican Party. I guess, you know, how's it going? I mean, you do have a fairly coherent policy paradigm you're trying to push that is different than what the party has stood for, what conservatives recently have stood for. You know, how much influence does this way of thinking about things, how is that developing within the party? I mean, I know you guys punch far above your weight, but the party's still a big, you know, unwieldy apparatus with the, you know, the big orange man looming over it. You know, how much progress do you think is being made along these lines?
Well, I think there's a ton of progress that's been made. I think, you know, the reality is hard in two respects. One is that this is a long process. I mean, this kind of sort of transformation in both the political base and the sort of intellectual architecture and agenda of a party typically plays out sort of, you know, over a decade or two. I mean, you know, Reagan's famous speech for Goldwater was 16 years before before Reagan was actually elected. You know, Clinton and the New Democrats started working in the early 1980s to what then finally led to the New Democrats succeeding in 1992. And I think one thing that feels strange or different this time around is that you have Trump there, and that Trump actually won in 2016. I think the more typical pattern would be you have a figure like Trump lose, probably quite decisively to a competent Democrat, which frankly I think he would have in 2016.
Right. Yeah.
And that then, you know, you still, something like a Trump nomination still signals the turmoil and start of a real rethinking within a party, but it tends to happen more sort of off to the side. You know, you even had you got two terms of Richard Nixon before you actually got to Ronald Reagan. And so it looks more like, well, why isn't this already happening? You are in power in a sense in the Republican Party, but the process still has to play itself out. And I think the second related point to make about this is that the elected leaders are always going to be the lagging indicator. I mean, by the time you get to be a senior senator, it means you've been doing this for, you know, 30 or 40 years, and your own commitments, your positions, your relationships, your donor base, your staff, it is all committed to the old thing. And so you sort of tend to see a generational change as one group retires and the next one sort of takes over, is when a set of shifts that have been going on behind the scenes really break out into the open. And so what we see at this point is that, you know, if you look at conservatives under the age of 40, give or take, the overwhelming majority, especially when you're talking about those who are, you know, most effective and talented and already or likely to be influential, the overwhelming majority are already on this side. You see it happening now with, you know, with other sorts of institutions, publications, think tanks, where you increasingly see it shifting. And then if you actually look at who is the next generation of elected leaders, who are the most, you know, certainly engaged and effective legislators, who have the interesting ideas, who have the momentum, it is particularly in the Senate that younger generation of, you know, J.D. Vance, Josh Hawley, Marco Rubio, those folks are exactly the ones who are identified with with this newer conservative economics. And as you see them move into leadership, as you see the next generation come up behind them, I think in a sense, this transformation is already baked in. It takes time to play out.
Yeah. Okay. So you're playing the long game. That's defensible. What would you say though to the objection that long game or not, there are certain structural problems with the Republican Party that just may prevent it from unfolding as you wish? I mean, take for example the continuing and large influence of basically of conservative business interests who are mostly see the Republican Party as a vehicle for advancing their own interests and lining their own pockets. And they have a lot of influence and they have a lot of money. That's historically that connection between at least certain sectors of the business community and Republicans is strong. Now, we know that's changing a lot. Business as a whole is no longer on the side of the Republican Party, obviously, with the changes in finance, Silicon Valley. But they're still loom pretty large. And in addition to that, there's still an intellectual strain in the Republican Party and among conservatives that isn't really that different than, you know, the sort of standard Reaganite formula, maybe with some slight modifications. We'll take the whole debate between national conservatives and freedom conservatives. Maybe you could explain that to our listeners, what that is, because I know you have opinions about it. But it's not like those people are going away. And if they're not going away, how do you see, I mean, is it really just a matter of they'll gradually move in your direction, or is there some sort of compromise that could be made? And I'm just sort of curious the mechanics of how this might happen. I mean, I agree there's a contradiction between the currently existing state of the Republican Party and its base and the things it probably needs to do to succeed over the long term, but parties don't always do the right thing. So what would you say to all that?
Well, it's certainly true that parties don't always do the right thing. And, you know, I think one could envision a scenario where you see the Republican Party sort of turn back in a sense. I think the best case for that is the one you started with the sort of financial infrastructure. It's certainly the case that most of the sort of donor class is obviously much more committed intellectually and more so pecuniarily. I don't know exactly how I would say this. They have a strong pecuniary interest in in the older way, in the older model. Mm-hmm. I think the flip side is that the reality, certainly in my experience, is that the vast majority of folks in the sort of donor community care 98% about being connected with the winners, and about 2% about about the actual marginal tax rate. And one way to see this and keep it in mind is just look at all of the big money support for the Democratic Party, right? There's the Democratic Party has never struggled to fund itself. And obviously, labor is a piece of that. And the very interesting question of what happens to labor and the actual energy of working class organizing in the long run. But at the same time, this is always, I think about it, I call it the what's the matter with Kansas, where there's mm-hmm. there's always been this strange way that analysts say, look at these, working or lower middle class Republicans who are kind of voting against their financial interests. And no one ever asks about what about all the rich Democrats? Like, are they all crazy? And you realize mm-hmm. Oh no, I see what you're doing. You just like Democrats better. But by and large, people's affiliation with a party, people's commitment to an agenda, yes, it has something to do with tax rates and personal financial interest, but it much more has to do with one, okay, of the choices available to me, which team would I rather be on? And two, do I get to hang out with winners? Mm-hmm. And so if you have a situation where, as between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, a lot of people still ultimately would prefer what what the Republican Party is offering, and you combine that with, and the only Republicans who are winning are the ones who are talking about this set of stuff, my guess is it won't be a problem at all. And obviously Trump is sort of a case study in this. Now Trump has point, you know, what did Trump do? He went back and did a big tax cut.
Right.
But certainly on trade, on immigration, you know, Trump actually sort of tried to pursue the things he said he was going to pursue. And so I think that if that is who is going to actually be winning the elections, then that is also where you will see all of the energy and money and talent flow.
Yeah, but Trump is such a chaos agent. He's not exactly a policy guy. You have a very well-defined, coherent, and I think plausible set of policy recommendations, but it's one thing to have something like that, and it's another thing to have a Trump administration really follow through on a lot of this stuff, because it's going to be, well, chaotic and, you know, a lot of wires hanging from the ceiling and contradictory moves and so on. I mean, what, when you think about it, you know, as a thought experiment, let's say Trump wins, we've got Trump administration number two. How much do you think American Compass and people like you can really influence what he's likely to do, what the administration's likely to do?
Well, I think it's always difficult to predict certainly what Trump is going to do.
Especially about
and,
the future.
And also who's going to influence him. You know, the reality is that, and we saw this the first time around, you know, there's the sort of cliche that personnel is policy. And that's always to some extent true. But of course, in a situation where the principal has a very clearly defined agenda and is choosing people who are going to carry out that agenda, then at the end of the day, policy is policy. In a Trump administration where the principal tends to be a lot more flexible on a lot of the actual policy commitments, and the set of people who might come in different roles also can be drawn from all different factions with very different points of view. It is especially true, and we saw this last time around, that who is actually ends up in these positions and who they listen to is going to have a huge amount of influence over the direction that policy takes in all different areas. So, you know, I think certainly one difference from 2016 is that you actually have the potential to do a lot of good things. I mean, there actually is now a policy agenda. There is now a set of you know, talented younger policy wonks and administrators who can take up these positions and do good work. But there's certainly no shortage of other options as well. And so my guess is we'll see if there is a Trump administration, you know, significant progress and very good policy in some areas. We'll probably see the opposite in some areas. But I would return to the point I made earlier about what's going on in Congress, because the other lesson from 2016 was Congress played a much stronger role in determining the direction of policy than it typically does. I mean, you would never see a sort of Democratic Speaker of the House in a Biden administration kind of dictating the terms of policy. The direction would come down Pennsylvania Avenue in the other direction. But in the Trump administration, you did see what did they actually end up doing. They tried to do Obamacare repeal. They did a big tax cut because those were the two things on Paul Ryan's list. And what you'll see this time around, I think, is, you know, you have a set of folks on the Hill, and we'll see who controls each chamber in this hypothetical situation. But whether it's, you know, Jason Smith as chair of Ways and Means and what that would mean for tax and trade policy, whether it is folks like Vance, Rubio, Hawley in the Senate, what those guys want to do is actually going to be hugely determinative of what policy gets pursued. And so I think that's a significant opportunity and something that just didn't exist in 2016, where those sorts of congressional leaders weren't really in position.
Yeah, I'd take that as mild optimism. Some good things could get done. Actually, it kind of a thought occurred to me as you're talking about that. Do you think Democrats make a mistake? And I think basically the way they all look at a second Trump administration is, if not, you know, sort of the Weimar Republic 1933, you know, fascism will immediately establish. They just think it'll, you know, be total chaos. Nothing good will happen. And are they prepared for the idea or the possibility that there might actually be some things that are done that are like sort of ordinary people and voters like, and that actually sort of work? Or do you think, I mean, my sense is they completely discount it, but I'm curious as to your reaction, whether that might be a problem for them politically.
Well, I think it could certainly be a problem for them politically. I think, you know, part of the reason that they discount it is sort of motivated thinking, in a sense. It is not obviously a future that they want to see play out. It's also obviously not likely to be one in which they could play a sort of constructive role. I think one of the biggest problems we have in American politics today is the so-called kind of Trump derangement syndrome, where, you know, if Trump is for something, then you as an upstanding progressive must be against it.
Yeah, I hear that, brother.
And that's, to be clear, that's not to say actually you progressives should be for Trump, right? Like there are plenty of things, obviously progressives and even many conservatives find deeply objectionable about Trump. But I mean, immigration is probably a classic issue at this point, where because Trump staked out such aggressive and controversial positions on immigration, Democrats basically back themselves into this corner of, therefore, the only moral thing to do is take the exact opposite approach and say we shall have no immigration policy or enforcement, which, you know, isn't actually what Democrats thought until very recently, and is neither good policy nor good politics for them. You know, trade in China has been an interesting issue, where you actually have seen some Democrats and some members of the Biden administration committed to carrying forward the Trump policies. But you also see others who sort of, well, you know, if Trump's position is to be hard on China, then that must be irrational, and therefore we will prove our seriousness by instead leaning into to trying to embrace China. And so I think you can kind of expect that generally. I certainly don't see any sign of that habit breaking, and that anything that the administration chooses to take up, if there's a Trump administration, Democrats have basically positioned themselves to have to strongly oppose, because it is not possible in their worldview for Trump to do anything that they might either support or at least want to sort of play a role in trying to shape. And so that is what I would expect to see for the most part. If you do have a Trump administration, it obviously provides an enormous political opportunity for the Republicans to jam up the Democrats by doing otherwise popular things that Democrats then find themselves having to oppose. The reality is that a Trump administration's capacity to execute that sort of strategy effectively was not strong last time around, and it's not clear whether it would be in a second term.
Could be a bit questionable. Yeah. Oren, you said you had some new polling data. Do you want to share that with us? What's going on there? I mean, I'm always a maven for new data. So if you got some, lay it on us. What's going on?
Yeah, sure. We've really stepped up our work on polling in recent months, and we'll continue to do more of it, because we found, especially in this era of political realignment, with, you know, who is identifying with each party shifting, the picture is rapidly shifting on what the views of people in the parties are. And likewise, I think there's just a lot to be learned from asking people what they actually think. You know, I think not just as a political matter, but as a substantive matter, what people say they care about and what they believe actually can tell you a lot about what is happening in the country. And so the most recent round that we've just started to release looked at questions about the size and role of government. And, you know, of course, historically, the idea has kind of been this conflict between a Democratic Party for bigger government and a Republican Party for smaller government. And what we found is that's not really the case anymore. I mean, one might ask, to what extent was it ever really the case? You know, something
operational liberalism and all that. Yeah.
Well, and that's right. And, you know, something that Trump showed all the way back in 2016 was that, you know, going to bat for entitlements and so forth was very popular with the Republican base.
Yes.
But I think especially, you know, as you see that kind of quintessential cocktail party, oh, I'm socially liberal and fiscally conservative Republican moving into the Democratic Party. And you have, you know, and these are the ones who think that, well, you know, I should say I'm for entitlement reform and that makes me a serious person. And conversely, you have the sort of much more diverse working class base, particularly among non-white voters, folks who tend to have a much more positive opinion of even the federal government. And then generally a set that tends to have had more experience, in fact, benefiting from government programs. As those folks move into the Republican Party, this sort of, well, one party just wants to expand government and spend more, one party just wants to cut government and spend less, might not be true. And, and so what we found in the polling data is that that's very much the case, that Republican voters, self-identified, actually don't differ very much from Democratic voters at this point on a lot of broad questions. So in terms of, you know, particularly when it comes to faith in state and local government, Republicans actually have quite positive views of their state and local government. They do not have a positive view of the federal government. And we could certainly talk more about that. But then when you ask questions about sort of, you know, how do you feel about the kind of general stances that at least on the right, I think a lot of professional conservatives assume to be very absolute. So for instance, you know, can government do anything right? Should government be doing less, just do much less? Or are there some things you should do less of, some things you should do more of? You know, if you ask as a rule of thumb, you know, is government helpful? Is government unhelpful? Or is there no rule of thumb? It depends on what the problem is. Mm-hmm. Republicans actually look almost exactly like Democrats in terms of saying, look, there are some things we want government to do more of, some we want them to do less of, and there's no rule of thumb. Sometimes government is unhelpful, sometimes government is helpful. Even when you ask directly and, you know, say, like, focus on the federal government, say, would you prefer, you know, lower taxes and the federal government to do less? Only 61% of Republicans choose that option. And okay, look, 61%, that's a healthy majority. But for something that has kind of been the assumed table stakes position, that obviously the almost core commitment of the Republican Party is lower taxes and smaller federal government, that there's a significant share of even the Republican Party that doesn't feel that way anymore. And again, when you look at state and local government, there's not even a majority of Republicans who say we would like lower taxes and to see the government doing less. And so I think, you know, again, partly that's just a really interesting political reality when you think about how Republican politicians speak. But I also think there's a really important substantive finding there that, in fact, the people out in the real world who interact with government, who deal with all of its inefficiencies, who benefit potentially from its programs, generally speaking, they have mixed to positive views on it and think there are a lot of things it should be doing. And that in a sense is a real vote of confidence in government's ability to solve problems. And I think it certainly presents a challenge for Republican politicians trying to navigate how they speak about those kinds of things.
Yeah, I hear that. I think that's consistent with sort of the ways in which the party is changing, because it is much more dependent on the votes of working class voters who do have this kind of mixed view of the role of government, who don't have a particular ideological take on how small government should be. They just want they want stuff to get done, and they want it to help them, and they're pretty agnostic about exactly the right size of government. This fits with Patrick Ruffini's theory, I guess, about the multiracial working class, you know, ongoing realignment toward the Republican Party and how that's changing. You know, sort of what the Republican Party stands for and what it has to respond to, which I guess would fit into your long game kind of theory about how some of the changes you're looking for might come about. I mean, even if Republicans, some intellectuals, some businesses are still resistant to this kind of these kinds of changes, when your base changes, the people you respond to change, you kind of have to do things different. And at least the medium to long run. Is that, would you say that's a fair characterization of what's going on?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the, you know, something that that is going to be a really interesting phenomenon also is that this is happening in both parties. I mean, we were kind of joking mm-hmm. earlier about the Democratic Party going crazy. It is an interesting challenge that there's sort of a self-reinforcing cycle here, where as the Republican Party starts to adopt positions that appeal more to this broader working class base, the party becomes broader and more working class. That fuels more interest in those sorts of policies. This sort of reinforces these processes, and I think, again, over the medium to long term, kind of builds that momentum. Of course, the opposite is going to be happening in the Democratic Party. As that working class base leaves the Democratic Party and generally is getting replaced by the sort of higher income, educated former Republicans who are sort of so committed to the socially progressive view that they'll hold their nose on tax rates or whatever. Frankly, that makes things harder for the Democratic Party. I mean, it polarizes on exactly the dimension where there is no plausible majority for what the Democrats are likely to be standing for. And even, you know, I was writing a column about these polling results. And, you know, one thing I was thinking through is, well, step one is, okay, Republicans start to think more seriously about preserving some of these programs, maybe even needing to raise more tax revenue in some cases to mm-hmm. fund them. The more interesting thing comes in step two, in some senses, when you now have a bunch of Democrats who say, well, wait a minute, but we're the ones who pay those taxes. We want to cut the taxes. And that sort of, you know, you already see it in little things like the SALT deduction fights.
Yeah, right.
But that, I think, is something that could become a much bigger issue on the Democratic side. Now, obviously, all of these trends are only true until they're not anymore. And one thing that you would expect to see is that at some point, if you have a left that is losing, they start to respond and figure out what they have to do differently. And that's democracy in action working properly. It feels extremely frustrating in any given election cycle, but over decades, that's how a nation kind of course corrects and finds an equilibrium. So I don't think there's a sort of permanent conservative success here, but I think these sorts of corrections have the potential to actually refocus our politics generally on the real problems that we have and the people who need help. And that would be a very good thing.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I've always paid more attention than a lot of my comrades on the left to what's going on the right and what interesting conservatives had to say. I've come a long way since I used to close the door at CAP and read your stuff inside a comic book or something, Orrin, because I didn't want people to realize what I was reading. But, I just think there's a lot of interesting thinking going on in both the right and the left. And we'd all be well served by cross-fertilizing, listening to one another, grappling with the actual proposals and ideas people have instead of caricatures of them. And I think, you know, Orrin, you and the American Compass just play a tremendous role in helping make that happen. And, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I'll just hold up this great Rebuilding American Capitalism, Catch the Fever. People can easily find American Compass by just pointing your browser at American Compass. And there's a ton of great stuff on the website. And I'll be looking for, your column and other releases from your new polling data. Anything else you want to add here, Orrin, before we sign off?
No, this was great. Just to say, I mean, we appreciate your partnership with us. You're a wonderful contributor to some of our projects, and certainly we are avid readers, and now we'll be listeners to your work as well. So really appreciate you having me on.
Hey, I just very appreciative that you were able to come on, and I would add to the listening masses out there, next time we'll have Chris Steirwalt, everyone's favorite country pundit, on. So that'll be lively and interesting. I hope to see you all there, or hear you all there. And I think we'll just sign off now and say bye-bye, Orrin. Thanks again. This was fantastic.